League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast, presented by SportsShoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Every Sunday we get together with a guest from the distance running world,
giving you an insight into the lives and training of some of the UK's best athletes and coaches.
You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all major podcast streaming services.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Podcast, where we post about our past and present guests, host giveaways, and much more.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Hey guys, welcome back. First off, hope you all had a good Christmas and New Year if you were celebrating. But for this week's episode, we spoke to Philly Bowden. Philly's got PBs of 15.52 in the 5K, 32.33 in the 10K, and she's representing Great Britain in the track and on cross country. Look, as well as chatting to Philly about her success in running, we also wanted to chat to her about some of the experience she's had with disordered eating and how that's influenced her athletic career. Philly's spoken about this before in an article that we've linked in the description for this episode. And on the subject of disordered eating, Philly quite rightly wanted us to warn you as listeners that we will be covering some topics that you may find uncomfortable, so please listen with caution. If you're interested in some extra resources around this as a topic, we've included a link to a website that Philly also suggested that may help.
Hello, welcome back. Yes, 2022. Happy New Year, everybody. Thank you for tuning in once again. I hope you all had a good Christmas as well and you get yourself off for a good long run today. But yeah, but like Ollie said, a bit of a different episode this week with Philly, but you know, we thought it was important to kind of cover this topic, even though quite a lot's been documented around eating disorders. But you know, we spoke to Philly about, kind of went into a little bit more detail how eating disorders develop and what the kind of signs are early. And then on top of that, obviously we talked about her going to Oregon and her success as like a under 20 and under 23, and obviously, yeah, then eventually going out to Oregon and what training and, you know, her lifestyle was like out there, as well as, you know, negotiating eating disorder. But we also talk about the recovery process and realistically, how long is that recovery process? Obviously, it differs for everyone as well. And kind of just what steps to take if you know someone going through it or you are someone going through it. Hopefully, it's just going to help you and just kind of educate everyone around the topic a little bit more, because it's a topic which, you know, doesn't seem to be going away in our sport. So yeah, that's pretty much it this week. Like I said, something a little bit different, hopefully something a little bit sort of refreshing as well from the hard, you know, gritty sort of athlete content we usually bring you. So yeah, look, take care, enjoy, and we'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Right, just Philly, first of all, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, how's things with you then?
Yeah, good. I've just was packing my bags this morning actually, because I'm heading up to Telford this afternoon. So yeah, just got a race this weekend, been chilling this week, had a couple of days off. So quite nice.
Yeah, that the 10K tomorrow then, is it?
Yeah, 10K at Telford. Yeah. I've done it before. Quite a quick course. Mm-hmm. So yeah, looking forward to it. I didn't realise how far away it was though. It's like almost a 3-hour drive. So mentally preparing myself for that.
Yeah, for sure. But look, anyway, we've got kind of a few things we want to cover today. I just want to say thanks for coming on, because obviously in addition to like your running career, like you've also had an article recently published in the Telegraph, like with you talking about kind of having an eating disorder and stuff. So thank you for being willing to talk about that. First off, would you mind just talking about your decision to, I guess, choose to not be anonymous in terms of your representation in the article and why you actually decided to do it in the first place?
Yeah, so I mean, I know a lot of athletes have kind of opened up about their experiences either with like disordered eating or Red S in the past, like, which I think is amazing, and it's a really difficult thing to share. I think it depends who you are, obviously, but there's certain aspects of our lives that like you just want to keep private, or maybe you just don't want to bear all on social media. So I've always admired people that have done that, but for me, I've never really felt sort of that I needed to do that. And I suppose when the Oregonian article came out, which was the article in Oregon written by Ken Goh, and there was, I think it was 5 or 6 ex-Oregon athletes that sort of said that they'd had issues with disordered eating as a result of some of the like circumstances on the program over there, and they chose to remain anonymous. And it was actually my coach that sent me the article and sort of said, like, have you seen this? And it just sort of took me back to that place when I was over there and was just like really not in a very good place. And that's the first time that I've sort of felt compelled to say something, because I am in a really good place now, in contrast, and I sort of thought, I feel ready to talk about this. So yeah, that's sort of how it came about.
Yeah, it's amazing to hear that, like, you're like recovered and you say like you're in such a good place now. And I guess, like, I mean, Philly Leo, I remember seeing you like progress. Like, we kind of grew up through the age groups together at the same club, which is cool. So we have a little bit of a friendship there. But when you went to Oregon, you must have thought, mate, like, for any sort of 18 to 24 year old, that is like the holy grail of track and field and training and progression.
Yeah.
And thought, like, I've hit the jackpot. So just tell us, like, how you came about going to Oregon and what your thoughts were going in and when you first started to see like the red flags.
Yeah, I definitely like was buzzing to go to Oregon, and at the time as well, just sort of felt like quite sort of nervous about it because it's prestigious. Like, it's the hub of distance running of America, like, you know, an amazing place to even just visit, let alone like train and live there. So, and it was quite weird actually how I ended up going there, because I went on a couple of visits the previous year. I was talking to a couple of universities, one of which was USF, San Francisco. And that's actually where I committed to, because I got on with the coach there and I liked the setup. I loved the girls. It was a smaller school, loved the city, obviously, in San Francisco. And then like a few weeks before I was due to go, the coach called me up and said, you know, I've taken a job at Oregon. Like, I'm not going to be able to stay there and coach you. Like, I'm really sorry. But said, you know, I trust the assistant coach. He's going to do great. Like, I think he'll still be really well suited there. So I sort of was a bit bummed by that, but thought, yeah, I'm just going to stick with it. And then I think it was like a few days later that I actually found out that the assistant coach was moving on as well. And I was just like, oh, for God's sake, like, I went and visited these schools and like, there's so many things that have to fall into place. Mm-hmm. And you still can't control everything that will mean that you're going to have a good ride out there. So I was sort of like umming and ahhing what to do, and I was so excited to go out there. And then it transpired that, you know, the coach called me up and said, we can bring you over to Oregon. It won't be on a full scholarship, but like, this is what we can give you. Mm-hmm. And it was enough to live off of. It was enough to cover my rent, enough to cover like most of my groceries and stuff. And luckily I was in a position that my parents could send me like a little bit of pocket money just to like top me up. And then, yeah, like a few weeks later, the way that it works over there is the terms start later in Oregon because they're on a quarter system, whereas most unis are on like a semester system. So right. It meant that I waited a little bit longer to sort things out before I went out there, quickly found a program, applied to it, like found some references that were like a little bit shoddy and got on the course. And then, yeah, flew out there having never been to Eugene, not met any of the girls, was just like, didn't almost believe it was going to happen until I got there, and then arrived in Eugene.
Arrived in Eugene, having fun, you know, gelling with the team, and then, you know, you mentioned in the article as well, like you had an eating disorder like a couple of years prior, so which you'd kind of experienced. You just want to give us a background on that, you know, how that compared to Oregon.
Yeah, my disordered eating started like a long time before I went out to Oregon, so I was just starting sick form, and like loads of things were going on at home. Like, I was just dealing with a lot, and that's just when it started for me and surfaced. And to be honest, I don't think I really got the appropriate level of help at the age when you're under 18. Like, I know a lot of people have experienced like CAMS, which is like the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service, and it's just like the waiting lists are ridiculous. Like, they're so under-resourced, like they're just not in the position to help you almost until like you really really need help, which is just so backwards, because the best thing to do is prevent these things before they happen. So I had that, and then I had a couple of years, I took a year out before I went to uni in the UK. And that was actually at a time where I was probably in a really rough place, really underweight, actually having like outpatient treatment, and that was in like 2013 to 2014, and that was when I was diagnosed with anorexia. I then went to uni. I went to Brunel, sort of abruptly stopped my treatment because I was moving. I was going to uni, and I was like, no, this is more important. And then whilst I was at uni in the UK, things were kind of up and down. I would be in a good place. Like, it would sort of depend on like what was happening the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. It was always sort of correlated, you know, if I was stressed or there were things going on, like that would translate into like issues with my weight or disordered eating and all of that. So I definitely didn't get the appropriate level of help. And I think it just kind of like rode whatever wave I was riding at the time. So yeah, I think, and when I went out to America that year, like during my dissertation, finishing uni, had been like quite a rocky one, in terms of like how that translated into my eating and stuff. So but that summer I was actually in quite a good place when I went out there. I felt healthy and I felt at a place where I was like ready to sort of just nip it in the bud and, you know, have a fresh start out there.
Look, being a 25 year old male, Lum will probably laugh at me here, and but you know, one of my flaws is that I probably don't understand how an eating disorder develops. And there's probably a lot of people out there who think the same as well. So for someone like yourself, and I know like every case is individual, but how does it develop? You know, because you've kind of been through two. In the article, you mentioned how the Oregon one developed. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But how did that, like you say, 2013, 2014, you're in sixth form. How did that first one develop?
Yeah. And I wouldn't like distinctly call them separate, to be honest. I think it just evolves over time and like it changes, and it like was part of who I am, and probably still is to like a very small degree. Like, I think something will always be there, like at the back of my mind, but I'm in a place now where I just can shut that down straight away. Mm-hmm. And I think, so when I was at sixth form, there was a lot of change going on. Like, my parents had just split up. My dad had moved out. I moved schools. I just come out of a relationship. Like, there was just so much change, and I think my life felt so chaotic. And obviously I didn't make an active decision to like find something I can control, but that was what I could control. And it was my food intake, and it was like tracking all of that. And then I suppose like not feeling very happy with myself. So like wanting to change something, and yeah, like I honestly just like didn't like the way I looked. I didn't feel good about myself. And at that time, like, it wasn't, I don't think it was intertwined with running, because to be honest, I wasn't great at running back then. I think like running was just something that I'd always done. But as time went on, it definitely got intertwined with it, in the sense that, you know, you'd see people that are lighter than you or leaner than you. And then that would sort of sow the seed of like, well, this is something that I then need to do, or, you know, not in that sort of like as simple as that. But I think that kind of, yeah.
Like, did the Lum, I will let you speak in a sec, mate. But does the problem get worse, you know, as you've got an eating disorder, and it kind of, I don't want to say it mirrored like your performance increase, but you did, you know, you did progress tremendously in running through that time, you know, 2014 to 2018, you know, every year. So did that kind of reinforce yourself at the time? You were thinking, oh, maybe this is a good thing I'm doing right now.
I definitely didn't think it was a good thing. It was something that I was like completely ashamed of, and really just wanted to keep to myself. Like, it would have been like the worst thing if any of my friends found out. Like, I just really kept it secret. I think there were other things going on at that time. Like, I was quite a late bloomer in running. Like, I wasn't great as a kid. I never went to English schools on the track or anything. And then I changed coach like in my second year at uni as well. So I think, like, the reason my running improved is because I was training better and I was like running better as a result. But there were times definitely where, you know, I was in the depths of my eating disorder and like probably at the lightest I was, and was running the fastest I was. Mm-hmm. And that definitely troubled me for quite a while afterwards, because that was always at the back of my mind. You're sort of told like thinner doesn't mean faster, but then I'm like, but that's what happened to me. Mm-hmm. And now I'm able to sort of challenge that, because I'm in a really healthy place. I'm heavier than I was, and I'm running PBs. So,
Contrasting that, I guess, with something that's a bit more institutionalized in terms of at at Oregon. When was the first time you started seeing, I guess, the red flags we spoke about? And I guess with Oregon's reputation, as we discussed earlier, did that make you kind of question whether what you were seeing was actually what you thought it was?
Yeah, I mean, like in the article, the first sort of red flag for me was like a few days in. But I don't think I really realized it until later. You get all of these sort of like tests when you first arrive. A lot of them are for safety reasons, like they have to measure like your responses for concussion and things like that. Check that you're fit and healthy to compete and like that you don't have, you know, any issues in your scores or whatever. And part of the facilities at Oregon is that they have a DEXA scanner in their facility. So that's part of it. And they obviously check your bone density, which I think is great. Like I was really pleased to know that my bone density was in a good place. And obviously they can then track that each time that you have a measurement. I don't think it changes very quickly because it's something that takes quite a long time to build up your bone density. Right. But obviously like they check your weight and then your body comp as well, so like your muscle to fat ratio. And it was when like I had my results read out to me after being there for like a few days, and was asked, well, sort of told what my measurements were, and the nutritionist who was explaining the results just sort of said, it'd be great to see, you know, maybe like a couple of percent off of your fat percentage and maybe a few, like 2 or 3 pounds as well whilst we're at it. And I was just like, okay, sort of like took that on and then sort of walked out thinking, that's weird. Like, I thought this would be the benchmark measurement to be like, right, you're coming in. I've just run all my PBs that summer.
Yeah.
You know, this is like where you're at. This is where you I guess, need to be, like, and just kind of checking it and then making sure that it looks the same or roughly similar a few months later. I wasn't expecting to be asked to like change from day dot.
Did you girls on the team sort of share these results, talk about these? Like, did you feel pressure from that side of things as well? You know, talking to your teammates and being like, oh, you know, I need to hit these numbers, and they're like, oh, well, I've hit them, or same here.
No, I mean, we didn't really talk about like the numbers specifically amongst us. Yeah. And like, I didn't really share with my teammates like sort of that off the first reading. Like, I'd only just met them as well, so I didn't say that like, we were all really close at that point. But the team itself, especially in that first year, like we were really healthy. Sort of like the vibe amongst team members was like really good. Like, not sort of competing with each other for the wrong reasons or anything like that. So there was none of that really. But there was just sort of, there'd be talk like before the DEXAs coming up, like, and it would be sort of in a jokey way, but I think that was like, or I know that was sort of our way of dealing with it, like, because I've spoken to some of the girls since, we'd be like, oh, don't go to Puckler's, which is like the local amazing ice cream store that was like 200 meters from my apartment, and they'd be like, don't go to Puckler's until after you've had your DEXA, like, because it'll show up. And we joke about that, but now when you think about it, it's kind of like, oh, you know, have an ice cream for God's sake, like.
Yeah, 100%. Like, do you think it's a lazy way of coaching? Like, one of the things, is it quite a lazy mentality as well, and a lazy way of coaching, just to blame maybe a bad performance on, you know, on not hitting a certain weight or being a certain body fat percentage as well? Because obviously, you know, these terms do get chucked around in our sport, and that is part of our sport. And when people look for improvements, that's probably the first place they often look. So do you think it's quite like a lazy mindset of coaches to think like that?
Yeah, I think so. And I also think that it's maybe sort of foolishly seen as like an easy way to top up performance or an easy way to impact it quickly, because there's no way to get quick fit. Like, you got to work hard, tick all the boxes and do all the little things, go to the gym, do your S&C, get plenty of sleep, all of these things. But I think sometimes weight is seen as something that you can change quite quickly in an unhealthy way. And maybe it will give you like a short term like bonus and you'll get a good run out of it. But then that doesn't last out. How many times have we seen, you know, that happen and then a few months later, no one knows where that person is anymore, or they're injured, you know, and it's just not worth it. I think it's difficult. There's difficult conversations that sometimes are had about around weight, and maybe sometimes they have to be had, but I just think it shouldn't be the first port of call. Like, absolutely.
So there is a part of you which does agree that obviously to be an elite level distance runner, you have to be in physical prime condition.
Yeah, definitely. I think I've always thought like we're sort of like racehorses, and you think of all of the little things we've got to do. But I think at the same time, if you want to be doing this and you're putting all of that effort in all those other areas, you're not going to go and eat KFC every day for every single meal. Like, do you know what I mean? And I just think that there's a point where everything in moderation is okay. And there will be athletes that choose to completely cut out, you know, what they consider as like food that's not when they're supposed to be training and in competition, and they'll save it for their off season. Fine. But I think if someone chooses to have like chocolate every day in the evening, like one square of, you know, an advent calendar or something, then that's also fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Kind of at what point did you decide then that, look, with Oregon, it was past the point that you could, I guess, continue there?
Yeah, I think it was towards the end of my first year where I was sort of, I saw it as like, I have a choice here to either stick it out for the 2 years, my full 2 years of eligibility, or just call it quits and come home. And I think like pretty much going into my second year, I was like, I'm just going to finish my degree, get that and leave. So I moved all of my credits, because I was doing a 1 year course anyway and like taking it over 2 years. So I had a really light load of sort of like classes, which is quite typical. Like if you go out there for a master's or even in your undergrad, to just have like less classes and sort of drag it out. So yeah, it was towards the end of that first year, and then going into my second year as well, like things got worse. So that just sort of solidified for me, like I need to sort of take myself out of this environment. And a lot of that at the time was just the fact that I wasn't running well. You know, I went out there to run at, you know, what I thought, you know, this is the best place for me. And my performances weren't up to my expectations or their expectations. And like, that was the reason I'd gone out there. Mm. So I wanted my running to improve as well. But I think slowly I started to realize that for that to happen, I needed to tackle the eating disorder. And that was also a huge part of what was causing my running not to go well out there. And, you know, that in, especially in the last term while I was out there, that's when the purging was happening, which is just like the worst thing, like the worst part of it all for me, because it's horrible. You don't want to talk about it. I found it so embarrassing and literally couldn't bring myself to even tell like my boyfriend or my parents. And it's obviously the worst thing for your performance. Like looking back now, I'm just like, no wonder I wasn't running very well. I wasn't happy for starters. But then it's almost like this like cycle of reinforcement that like you're not happy, you dislike yourself, you're not running well, the eating disorder's like all intertwined with that. And it just goes round and round, and I needed to change something basically. And when you're out there sort of not like isolated on my own, but like without my support network and just in this very intense environment where running is the be all and end all, I just had to go home.
Philly, I wonder as well, like, obviously it's very hard for you to talk about it when you haven't spoke to anyone about it before, but do you find, have you ever spoke to someone and found it, like, they found it hard to talk about it? Do you know what I'm saying? So, because yeah. I think it can be hard for yourself, but I think, you know, if there's people close to you as well, it can probably be quite hard for them to sort of hear you say these things.
Yeah.
And it not be awkward, but do you know what I mean? Like, them conversations must be difficult.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I've always found it hard to talk to anyone about it and like bring it up with my parents when, you know, throughout those years, like I knew that I had to say something, and it was just like, literally couldn't get the words out to talk to them. And obviously that's difficult for them. But then because I can't talk to them and explain how it affects me, they don't then know how to help or how to talk to me about it. And there were loads of little things like over the years that like just triggered me, like something that my parents would have said or my family would have said that they didn't realize that would have been, you know, maybe not the best thing to say. I can remember once, like, I think it was in my year out before I went to uni, and I came downstairs and like had a bowl of Shreddies at like 10:30 at night. And my dad was like, what are you doing? Why are you having cereal?
Parents will never understand cereal at night though.
Yeah.
The generation.
And I think I'd literally hardly eaten that day. And I just like flipped out at him. hungry for starters, like, and also just like didn't want that comment and like just threw the cereal, like, but like little things like that. And yeah, like it's definitely hard for other people to talk about it as well, I think, when you don't fully understand it or understand what it's like being in it. Definitely like the easiest people I've found it to talk to have been people that have been through it themselves.
Could you spot an eating disorder in someone else? Because I think that's, like we just said, you know, there would be people close to you or people, you know, others out there who are close to someone who maybe is going through an eating disorder, and they'll be too afraid to sort of spot it. You know, they may know in the back of their mind, but too afraid to sort of mention it as well. Yourself, for example, would you be able to spot one? Would you speak up?
I think sometimes it's difficult because they, you know, you can have an eating disorder in lots of different ways, and it doesn't necessarily always present itself in the, you know, dangerously thin looking person, which is like the most obvious sign. You know, and most people that have an eating disorder are very good at covering it up and hiding it. You know, none of my teammates had any idea that I was purging after meals. None of my friends at uni in the UK knew that I did that. And I think, yeah, it's difficult because whilst you're in it, you want to cover it up and hide it from everyone because you don't want to talk about it and you don't want anyone to kind of try and tell you any differently, almost. But there are things like, if you know what to look out for, you know, if someone's getting up and weighing themselves every morning, or like weighing themselves after meals, or there's just certain things that they're very particular about, you know, I would read the back of lots of like packets of whatever I was eating and sort of I had this sort of almost internal calculator of what was in everything, and I kind of knew the kind of calories or fat percentage and things like that of food. Which is horrible because then you can't almost unlearn that.
Sometimes
it's still there when you almost don't want that. Or you go to a restaurant and they've got the calories next to the food and I'm like, oh, goodness sake. But yeah, there's lots of little things. And even now, my boyfriend, like, he's sort of noticed things that he thought were just things that I had that were my sort of preferences around food, but actually were part of the eating disorder. So like, we were making a hot chocolate the other night. He's like, oh, you only want it, you like it quite weak, don't you? And you want like 1.5 spoons. And I'm like, no, babe, put like 3 or 4 in. Like, I want it to taste like chocolate. And he's like, oh, I swear you're quite funny about that. And I was like, mm-hmm. Like, yeah, so yeah, yeah, he's sort of learning things like that that's changed as well over the last couple of years.
Mm. On that then, I guess main thing is, do you have any advice for people who might be experiencing some of the things that you've discussed today, and I guess, or if they've seen things in other people that you've discussed today, have you got any advice for people who might be listening?
Yeah, I suppose I wish I'd taken my own advice, because I still would have said this to someone sort of like 3 or 4 years ago, but the best thing you can do is talk to someone, reach out to a friend who you think, you know, will listen and not judge you. And ultimately, you can't just bury your head in the sand and like get over it on your own. You need help, you need to talk to someone. And like, therapy is not, like, therapy is a good thing. You know, that is there for a reason and it helps people. And yeah, I suppose if you suspect that a friend or someone that you know is going through that, then, you know, just ask them if they're okay. It's very difficult to approach that with someone, because I think a lot of people won't want your help or want your input, depending on where they're at with it. It's, you know, it's mental health at the end of the day, and it's a very difficult, complicated sort of disorder, or group of disorders, I suppose. So yeah, I suppose it's just sort of like being a good friend and being there for people. It's difficult if you're not a friend, if you're a stranger, sort of trying how to do that, but maybe speak to someone they are close with if you're worried about someone. Probably the best thing.
Sure. Was it like a big relief when you finally got that off your shoulders?
Massively. I think when I first spoke to someone, I confided in the nutritionist in the States, right, and it was the first time that I've spoken candidly about it, and sort of just, it was like this huge weight was lifted off me, and it was like this secret that I'd been holding back for so many years was was out there, not in the open for everyone, because I wasn't ready at that point in time to do that. But even now, like, I'm so proud of myself for talking about it and being honest with myself about it and not being embarrassed, because I shouldn't be embarrassed. It's just something that happened and something that I experienced, and I've come out of the other side of it now. So yeah, definitely, I suppose it sounds like a bit of a cliche, but it was a huge weight lifted talking about it.
I just quickly want to, you have come out the other side and you're recovered, and obviously the recovery process will probably vary, but you know, how long do you think it took you to fully sort of, you know, get over it? And from talking now, you seem like you're in a really good place, so you know, to fully get over it all, you know, how long would you say it took you?
It's definitely a gradual thing. And like that, there were definitely periods of time at uni where I felt that it was dormant for a few months or something, and you know, it didn't affect me so much, but I wasn't sort of over it because it would come back. But now, I think when I came back from America, that would have been Christmas 2019, and even just coming home, I felt better straight away because I was sort of taken out of that really intense environment. But I think the sort of 6 months to the summer, and then probably a year full circle, the improvement was immense. And I changed a lot in my life over that time as well. Obviously, we had like the pandemic started in March, April time. So, and in hindsight, for me, that was probably a good thing for my eating disorder, because there were no races, there was nothing else to focus on. I mean, like, mind-numbingly boring. I was also unemployed at that time, so I was so bored. But I was just running for myself and just running to keep fit and just like enjoy it, and also moved in with my boyfriend's parents at that time, like for the first lockdown, and it was the first time that I just sort of felt really chilled around meal times and food and everything. And his mum is Greek, and sort of food is like the centerpiece of their family and life, and it was a really good thing for me. I had no control over what was going into my meals and things, but I didn't feel anxious about it. And actually, like, that was the first place I've lived, and then consequently living in London for a year, where the house itself, you know, I hadn't purged in, and I was like, wow, I realized that the other day. So it's been a good couple of years, which is just, yeah, awesome.
Yeah. I mean, that's so good to hear. And you've had, like, I've seen a lot of good support for you, and then the article on social media and stuff, and hopefully people listening to the pod, this will help with that as well. And I guess just help other people who might be in similar situations. I mean, we just want to talk about your running and I guess your life now. Like, what are you up to now? What are you doing for work? And how's training going? Because it looks like you've had some good race results recently.
Yeah, no, it's been going really well. I'm currently a civil servant. I work from home. And I'm on their grad team, so every like 6 to 12 months my role changes, and so I'm working for a charity at the moment, pretty much exclusively working from home. I've been in the office like once, which works quite well with training. I'm coached by Helen Clear the Row now, so I moved to her August September time, I think, last year, and that was when I moved to London as well. We lived in London for a year, and then we're like, why are we paying this much money to live in London in the pandemic? We don't get to experience any of the good parts of living in London. We're just, you know, paying someone else's mortgage. So we're in Reading now, and I've got quite a good setup here. I hop in with the Reading AC sessions quite a bit on sort of Tuesdays, and then at the weekend, if the guys fancy it, I'll tell them what I've got, and you know, some of them will join in. Or even just being in the same place as them for my sessions, because obviously my coach relationship is sort of at a distance, and she sets all my training on Training Peaks. But it works really well, and I can just sort of work it around work and go at lunchtime if I want to, and yeah, just sort of fit in.
Yeah, shout out to Reading, best place to raise a family in the UK, so they say. yeah, no, it's cool you're coached by Helen Clear. I was going to ask, you know, how does that, you know, long distance thing work? You kind of touched one of their sort of training peaks, and do you communicate every day and stuff? And do you see her, or like just at races, you know, do you wait to link up there?
Yeah, I mean, I've literally seen her twice since she's been coaching me. Went up to Preston for like a long weekend. Yeah. With Mari, who's also coached by Helen, like last year. And then I saw her at Liverpool a couple of weeks ago. And I went to hers and Preston before because I was going to do a long run progression, like 18 or 19 miles on the like cycle path of Liverpool, because it was so windy. She convinced me to do it on her treadmill instead in her garage. So I don't see her really. She's the other end of the country. It will be at races. Or whenever I can get up there. I mean, if it wasn't for the pandemic, I'd probably go up there sort of like once a month or so and just have a weekend training with her. She sets my training on Training Peaks. I'll sort of know what the plan is for the week on Sunday, for the Monday coming up. And because at the moment I'm prepping for my first marathon in February.
I was going to ask you, you're going to do a marathon. Fair. You won the red in half, the sweet result.
Yeah, no, thank you. It was good. Yeah, I think I sort of decided after that. The marathon's been on my bucket list like forever. Right. And I've just been sort of like itching to do one. So after Reading, I sort of texted her and was like, when are we planning this marathon then? Like, I just want to do one. So I kind of have an idea of what's coming up at the moment because we had a big chat before, when we agreed that I was going to do it. And she just sort of said, you know, this is my plan, this is what I'm thinking, this is what the mileage is going to look like. And cross training is a huge part of my sort of training weeks now, so kind of have an idea of what's coming up, but she doesn't put it all on Training Peaks because, you know, it's a working plan, things can change, and she doesn't want me to look too far ahead, which I agree with. So
is cross training quite a bit big part of your week now, is it?
It never used to. I absolutely hated cross training like a couple of years ago. Think because I exclusively saw it as like, if I'm injured, I'm on the bike for a week. So I just resented it. But since I've been with Helen, we sort of learned that I'll just get these little niggles. I'll get like 8 weeks of consistent training in and then something will come up. And cross training is just quite a good way for me, at least, to just lift the pressure a little bit off of my legs. And I definitely feel the benefits. Like if I have a cross training day and then a session, my legs feel so much better for it. And I feel like I can put more quality into the session. And it's only replacing, you know, extra easy miles. So my doubles are all cross training rather than going out for a jog. I say at the moment I'm doing maybe like 2-3 hours a week cross training.
That's quite a lot.
I did an hour and a half yesterday on the elliptical in the evening, and I left it till Friday night, and I just was like, why have I done this?
That's what the Sunday podcast is for though.
I was definitely listening to the podcast.
On the marathon then, what are your targets kind of going in, because obviously it's a big year next year with loads of championships going down. Have you got an eye on the Commonwealth Games standards and things like that?
There is a lot next year. I don't want to get sort of too caught up in, I want to run this time for this champ, because that's never what it was about. It was about just running my debut and enjoying it, because I want to have a go at the marathon and move to the marathon in the future, like properly. All right, I guess I'm trying to do it now. But I think it's so important to enjoy your first one. And that's not to say that I'm not going to go all in and see how fast I can go. I think we're just going to kind of key off of my training and see what the target time is nearer to Seville, which is the one that I'm doing. The seeds have already been sown in my head. I'm sort of like 2:30 something, I don't know, low 2:30s I think would be great. I know the commie standard is 2:34, but obviously I'm not doing Manchester, and I suspect that they'll just take the first person across the line and commit to England anyway at Manchester. I think Europeans are 2:30, 2:30. So I think, you know, if everything went to plan and it was a good day, maybe, and if they take 40 teams, but I think the 10K is still like my true love at the moment, and that's what I'm still sort of like gunning for. And I think running the marathon in February gives me the option to do both, as in to prioritize the 10K but also do my debut, because Highgate's in May, but if I was to do Manchester, it's just not enough time to recover.
I'd agree with that.
I think that's a good attitude to have, to be honest. And it kind of seemed from the outside that seemed to be what was happening with Reading and your race there. It seemed like you just kind of going there and enjoying it.
Definitely. I just wanted to run like sub 75 at Reading. Mm-hmm. And I think it's happened to me before, like when I ran my 10K PB, I was trying to run sub 33. And when I just sort of like have that in the back of my mind and like I've got the time I want to run, but the main thing is to enjoy the race. I run so much faster than I intend to. Mm-hmm. And I just, like, my paces went out the window at Reading, like, halfway round. I started leading the race, and I had so much support on the course. I was just, like, I was just, like, grinning while I was running. I just looked like an idiot. Like, I was having so much fun. Yeah, I loved it. And I love running on the roads. Like, the atmosphere is just brilliant.
Yeah, really. It looked like that, wasn't it? When I saw a few videos of you at Reading, I was like, blimey, yeah, she's having a blast out there. A lot of people wouldn't have been, but to be honest, Philly, now it's been great to have you on and sort of share your experiences. I hope people learn a lot. And I mean, Ollie, have you got anything to add? I think we covered quite a lot here.
Yeah, I think that's all. I guess just best of luck in Telford tomorrow. And enjoy it, I guess, based off what you said about how you run well.
Always do. Well, Philly, it's been a pleasure. We'll let you go. Thank you very much.
No, thanks for having me.
Take care.
Cheers.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.